Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. How much sleep did you get last night? The National Health Institute recommends 7 to 8 hours for adults, but nearly 30% of us are clocking in less than 6 hours of sleep a night. Sleep deprivation makes it very difficult to function, while long-term sleep deprivation can take a deadly toll. In addition to contributing to tens of thousands of car crashes, people who consistently experience sleeplessness are at a greater risk for chronic diseases like hypertension, obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and even cancer. Data also suggests sleep deprivation differs among groups, men and women, and racial groups. Blacks and Latinos report sleeping 7 hours or less on average than whites and are twice as likely to have nodded off or fallen asleep while driving. Though this is self-reported data, more researchers are linking chronic sleeplessness or wakefulness with variances in health outcomes for racial and ethnic groups. So should we treat sleep as a social justice issue? What is driving these different sleep patterns? And what impact does this have on individual lives and communities? Last year, the CDC got a lot of attention after it cited lack of sleep as a public health epidemic. Are we taking sleep as seriously as we should? Today, we're joined by Lauren Hale, Associate Professor of Family, Population, and Preventive Medicine at Stony Brook University. Lauren serves on the Board of Directors of the National Sleep Foundation. Her research investigates sleep as an important mechanism through which social and policy environments affect mental and physical health. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Richard Stevens, a cancer epidemiologist and professor at the University of Connecticut Medical School. Since 1987, Richard's research has focused on the potential role of electric lighting in causing circadian disruption, leading to long-term consequences, including increased risks of breast cancer in women. Hi, Richard. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And Bryce Mander is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. Bryce studies the role of sleep in cognitive aging and dementia. He's been conducting sleep research for over 15 years. Hi, Bryce. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have all of you. So why don't we start off with a very basic question? Lauren, let's start off with you. Why is sleep so important?
Well, you already covered a lot of the ways in which sleep has lasting implications for physical health, for mental health, for quality of life, and even for cognitive functioning. We, as a species, rely on sleep to function well every single day, and both epidemiologically, experimentally, as well as anecdotally, we know that people function better on a sufficient restorative night's rest.
And Bryce, what would you add to that?
Well, what's amazing to me, and one of the reasons I study sleep, is just how many different aspects of our lives are touched by sleep. Whether it's brain health, whether it's physiological health, it seems to be one of the cornerstones of overall well-being in our physiology. It affects every single organ system in the body, and it seems to be helpful for promoting healthy aging, which is one of the reasons I study that.
And Richard, why do you dedicate so much of your time to sleep?
Well, I agree very much with what's been said. It's really essential to our well-being. The studies on sleep and sleep disruption, short sleep, are, on the other hand, confounded by what I call circadian disruption. And that is when you have short sleep, you're having more light, electric lights in the evening, early in the morning. And disentangling the two is very important. We have to have the sleep, and 7 or 8 hours a day is of sleep, real sleep, is very important. But we also need dark, a good dose of dark each day. Life has devolved for 3 billion years with about 12. Of course, it depends on the latitude and season, but of dark. And we don't sleep during that entire dark period, of course. That's 12 hours. But we need more dark than we're getting.
Right. I mean, there's so many interesting issues with that one, because we have so much light pollution now, pretty much regardless of where you live. But then the research that you do focuses on people who have, for example, overnight shifts. What happens when people, while most of us are sleeping, they're under pretty ugly lighting? And then, right? And then maybe they try to go to bed at 8 in the morning, but it's probably incredibly difficult.
Oh, shift work is real, real rough. And we've known for a long time, the occupational medicine people have known for a long, and epidemiologists known for a long time, that shift workers have lots of problems. And I think some have been mentioned, obesity, sleep problems, obviously. And now it looks like breast cancer, as well as very important social issues and well-being, day-to-day well-being.
Right. And so, Lauren, there's a lot of data out there about sleep. We're really starting to learn exactly how people sleep, and we'll talk about how you evaluate that. But you really talk about this as a social justice issue. When did you first start thinking about sleep as a social justice issue?
Right. Well, I entered the world of sleep through a different route than a typical sleep researcher. I came as a demographer and epidemiologist. I was simply interested in understanding why there are disparities in health, why there are racial disparities, educational disparities, something Michael Marmot calls the status syndrome. Why are some people healthier than others, and why does this fall along lines of social advantage or social disadvantage is a risk factor for poor health? And it was while I was doing research on that that I realized, hey, sleep matters for health, and maybe sleep is a mechanism, because people who aren't as well off socially or experience more social insecurity or social disadvantage aren't sleeping well, and that's causing the poorer health outcomes that we're observing. And so I started looking at that about 12 years ago in the early 2000s, and I was inspired by some of the great sleep researchers who agreed with me that there wasn't a lot known about the patterning of sleep socially. How do different people sleep from a population perspective, and did that explain differential health outcomes? Mm.
It reminds me of a teacher that I recently met who works in Richmond, California, and she said that when she comes to school on Monday, the majority of her students just flop on the desk and immediately fall asleep,
right,
because they, you know, they didn't have enough sleep over the weekend. Maybe they share a bedroom. There's not enough lighting. There could be fighting in the home. They didn't get enough to eat. And so right when they get to school, she says she knows that people, the kids, are going to fall asleep.
Right. Well, you hit on a lot of risk factors, social and physical risk factors, whether it has to do with what's going on in the family, what's going on in the bedroom, whether it has to do with light or sharing a bedroom. But you also alluded to it could be a Monday morning effect, because what's going on the weekend is teenagers are staying up late. And when they have to wake up early Monday morning, it's a social jet lag. They're waking up sleep deprived already, starting off their week on the wrong foot.
Right. And so, Bryce, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, how do you get this kind of data? I mean, if the CDC says it's a public health epidemic, and then Lauren says we need to look at sleep as a social justice issue, how do you look at it?
Well, I think I agree. Those are both true, and those are both supported by the data. And, you know, you just have to not only follow them from an epidemiologic perspective, but actually conduct very rigorous studies in lab where you look at their physiology of their sleep, you look at the timing of their sleep that was brought up earlier. That's really important. And I think that's relevant for the issue that we've just been brought up, because not only do adolescents stay up late on weekends, but in general, their circadian rhythms, particularly if you're looking at high school students, are shifting to be later. And our school systems are actually not aligning with that shift in their biology. And so chronically, they're actually showing up to school really tired. And what you're starting to see across the country is certain school districts are paying attention to that and paying attention to the science that's supporting that, and starting to shift school start times to being later. And when you look at districts that do that, you see improvements in grades, improvements in health outcomes, reduced acting out, and skyrocketing attendance in schools. And this is really helping them get higher SAT scores and get into better schools. So it's a really important issue, actually, for adolescents, too.
Lauren, did you want to jump in there?
Oh, I completely agree, and I'm very enthusiastic and excited to follow the school districts that are changing their school start time to later.
And so how do you think we should talk more about this as a social justice issue? Because it's pretty clear that, you know, people with low incomes have certain many disadvantages. I mean, the teacher in Richmond talked about many of them. And so there's that. And then you also have, because some studies kind of contradict each other, whereas it shows that people with higher incomes get more sleep, and then other studies show that those who have more education and have higher education sleep less because they might have, you know, they might be obsessed with work, like, you know, the tech industry, for example. So how do you deal with the contradictory surveys and studies?
I was wondering if there was going to be a tech industry question on this call. I am unfamiliar with a study specifically about that industry or about the magnitude of short sleep among the overworkers, but I will say that if you look at the population level, the majority of the population that is not getting enough sleep are those who are lower income, lower SES, minority, race, ethnicity, and it's the challenge of dealing with the underslept population is primarily among those who are come from more disadvantaged populations. And while, of course, I'm on a mission to help people from all types and stripes improve their sleep, I think as a social epidemiologist, I'm most concerned about helping those who are least capable of changing their sleep and well-being, because the choice of staying up all night or not falling asleep until 3 or 4 a.m. might be more in the control of the computer programmer who's doing a startup, whereas a single mother of three kids who's trying to make ends meet and anxious about how she's going to pay her bills and possibly if her ex-boyfriend's going to come by the house, she might not have that choice of whether or not she can fall asleep.
Yeah.
And those are the people that we should be concerned about from a social justice angle. But on the other hand, for all the listeners who might fall into the other camp, there are things you can do, too, to improve your sleep.
Right. I think you just hit it there. That's a choice.
Right.
Because I read this piece about some banks, Goldman Sachs, had to implement a no Saturday rule because the interns were feeling so overworked and they were having major, major health problems as a result of working 7 days a week.
Interesting.
At, you know, 60, 70 hours a day. And so they had to implement a no Saturday rule.
Do they have a time, too? No after 11 o'clock? Or?
No, I don't think so. It was just no Saturday.
The tech industry is really rethinking this. Arianna Huffington, now in the Huffington Post, you'll read stories about the importance of sleep all the time now. Mm-hmm. She evidently, about 5 years ago, I think it was, she was working that 60, 70, 80-hour week, and she actually fell asleep while she was walking in her office, fell and broke her cheek.
Wow.
And so they're really rethinking this. I mean, I agree with what's being said. If you starve yourself of sleep, you're not going to be more productive. You're going to be less.
And also, don't you think this there's a shift happening in society? Because when I got my first job out of college at a tech company as a tech reporter covering privacy issues, there was a sign on the CEO's door that said, sleeping is for wimps.
Yeah.
And lunch is for sissies. I mean, it was this really kind of awful work environment that they created, but you don't really hear that much more. So do you think that there's a shift happening? What are your thoughts, Richard?
Oh, yes, very much so. And I followed the Huffington Post and many other media outlets because of the kind of work that I do. I'm very interested in how science is communicated to the people who pay for it, which is, of course, the public. And I really applaud Huffington Post and other organizations, news outlets that are covering sleep more and more.
Do you agree with Lauren that we should think about it as, you know, this is a choice? So I stay up late because I do research for the show and there's so many things to read, and all of a sudden it's 1 a.m. But I'm really making a choice. Whereas a single mom with 2 kids who's got maybe, you know, an overnight shift, she doesn't have that choice to go to bed at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, that's a very good point. When I was talking to your producer about this, I hadn't really thought of it from that perspective, and we talked yesterday about it. And, yeah, you know, if you're in an inner city and you're low income and all these other pressures, you're not getting dark, and you are getting disrupted sleep in a big way. Now, I don't want people to be confused about what I mean by dark. This natural circadian rhythm, we go into nighttime physiology, and if you're out camping, it starts at around dusk. In our modern world, it's delayed because of things like smartphones. We get this blue light in our eyes. But you, if you're in the dark all night, you can wake up in the middle of the night, and you're fine. Your circadian rhythm will be just fine. If you turn on a light, you start changing into daytime physiology. You become alert. So that's the distinction that I'm trying to make. You need to be in the dark for good circadian health, but you don't have to be actually asleep. And this matters because a lot of us are starting to think, this is a big controversy in the sleep medicine world, that actually we are naturally biphasic sleepers. If we are out there camping, we sleep for 3-4 hours, wake up quietly in the dark for who knows how long, and then there's a second sleep.
Mm. So that's why it's important not to pick up your phone if you're having sleep issues at night.
Oh, if you wake up in the middle of the night, do not go into the bathroom and turn on those bright lights. Don't look at your smartphone.
Right.
And this is hard evidence from experiments in the laboratory, which Bryce mentioned in the laboratory, about what affects sleep and what affects our circadian rhythm.
What happens to us when, let's say we wake up at 3 a.m. and we're having a hard time getting sleep, and so we want to go read some articles. What happens when you turn on the phone?
Well, if it's 3 a.m, you're going to, what's called phase advance yourself, which means that you're going to, that melatonin drop is going to have, melatonin is sort of a hormone that's very important to circadian rhythmicity and almost surely to sleep as well. But if you turn on the light at 3 a.m, you're going to go get into daytime physiology all the faster. If you can stay in the dark and enjoy that period of contemplation calmly, you're better off.
And if you have to go to the bathroom, it's good to have a red light, right?
Yes, I started saying that a couple of decades ago, and I'm really proud of that. In Reader's Digest, I was quoted as saying that if you have to get up in the middle of the night, have a small red light in the bathroom. And I'm not kidding.
Yeah, because it can screw everything up if you turn on the regular light in the middle
yes.
of the night.
Yes, it'll make it a lot tougher to get to sleep. And we were talking about kids, young people, a little earlier. Lauren was talking about kids. Well, if they're using their smartphone in the evening or a tablet with that bright blue especially, they're making it harder for themselves to start to feel sleepy.
That is Richard Stevens. He is a cancer epidemiologist and professor at the University of Connecticut Medical School. Since 1987, his research has focused on the potential role of electric lighting in causing circadian disruption, leading to long-term consequences, including increased risk of breast cancer in women. We're also joined by Lauren Hale, associate professor of family, population, and preventive medicine at Stony Brook. She serves on the board of directors at the National Sleep Foundation. And Bryce Mander is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. He studies the role of sleep in cognitive aging and dementia. He's been conducting sleep research for over 15 years. Today, we are talking about sleep, why it's so important, what happens when we're sleep deprived. Last year, the CDC cited lack of sleep as a public health epidemic. Are we taking sleep as seriously as we should? And what about sleep as a social justice issue? How should we talk about that, and then how should we deal with it? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. As you're hearing us talk about the importance of sleep, how is this affecting you? Do you get enough sleep? What is your routine? Do you live in a noisy neighborhood or a disruptive environment? How does that affect you? if you work the graveyard shift or you work a lot of overtime, if you've got that ugly lighting, I'm kind of looking up at our lighting, it's not so great here, how does that affect your ability to sleep, especially if you work late hours? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Bryce, I'd love to hear your thoughts about choice, because I was kind of thinking about how to do this show today. As a social justice issue, you know, people who have no choice but to not get enough sleep, or who live in environments where, you know, it's not, they don't have the dark, or they don't have a lot of quiet time. Whereas those of us who are, you know, obsessed with reading or whatever it is, stay up late watching films, we do have the choice to go to bed at 10. And I think that's a really good way of putting it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's great, actually. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say, in certain groups of people, you have more of a choice than others. And to me, that's another example of privilege.
Right.
And that's why it's a social justice issue, right? But there's another group of people that have very little choice, and I'd just like to explicitly state that. People with sleep disorders often can't help that. And that's why it's so important to seek out a physician if you have a sleep disorder, if you think you have a sleep disorder, because treatment is going to be a really critical part of trying to achieve and working really hard to achieve a more restorative, better quality sleep. But yeah, there's a lot of aspects of choice in that, particularly like was talked about, the cultural pressure to stay in the office for 6 or 7 days a week and work 60 or 70 hours, you know, because there's all this social pressure, and then there's fear, oh, I'll lose my job if I don't do that. And that's when you have the choice, right?
Right?
And then you have other people, like the single mothers at home, who are worried about an ex-boyfriend coming over, or, you know, a lot of violence in the street. I mean, that's less of a choice. But also there's, you know, differences in sleep and differences in the properties of that as a choice, depending on what industry you work in as well. And you touched on that earlier, Rose, and you mentioned the tech industry. But there are other places where sleep is restricted voluntarily as well, like such as, you know, short sleep is pretty common in air traffic controllers. It's pretty common in, you know, medical residents. It's pretty common in the police force, actually. Police officers, on average, sleep less than 7 hours a night, and many of them take double shifts to make more money. And many of them are making life and death decisions while really short on sleep, and that can be pretty dangerous. Short sleep is common in the military, and it might be a contributing factor. There's evidence to suggest it's a contributing factor to developing post-traumatic stress disorder later. So there's a lot of consequences for that, and certain groups of people have more of a chance to have a choice there, and others less of a chance.
We've got 9,000 firefighters right now battling 24 major fires in Northern California. We can assume that they're probably not getting much sleep right now.
That's right. They are probably not.
And you'll notice that a lot of the professions that Bryce just mentioned are professions in which it's an emergency situation, people using weapons, guns or firearms, and these are not people you want to be sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. So, and I also want to thank you, Bryce, for mentioning sleep disorders as a source of insufficient, low-quality sleep, because it's not all about sleep duration. It's about sleep quality as well.
Right. And going back to the choice, Lauren, I was just thinking of another example. Say a single mom or even a family, you know, struggling to make ends meet, not knowing where the next meal is coming from. So that affects their sleep. And then that affects the child because the parents are incredibly stressed out about it. And then the child wonders if they're going to have enough for the next week.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been studied?
Not explicitly that question, but what I have done is I'm looking at a large sample of young children that have been studied in about 20 cities across the country, and it's a longitudinal study, about 5,000 children, and what we've shown is that in these low-income single-mother households, those households are the ones where regular bedtime routines and earlier bedtimes, both of which we know are beneficial for sleep, are less common. And I don't intend at all to blame the mother or the parents in this situation, but when you have high-end security.
And hold that thought. Yep. Right after the break, I'd love to talk more about the regular bedtime routine and how important that is.
Sure.
Today, we are talking about sleep. Are we taking it as seriously as we should? And what about sleep being a social justice issue? We'll be back after this.
Falling asleep there. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Voting Rights Act. The 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act is tomorrow. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that states with histories of disenfranchising voters no longer need federal clearance to enact new voter laws. So this year, 15 states will have more strict voting rules than they did in 2012. We'll talk about how this is affecting the right to vote and who is affected. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the importance of sleep and sleep deprivation. Unfortunately, if you don't get much sleep, you're at a greater risk for chronic diseases like obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's, even cancer. So we're talking today about whether or not we're taking sleep as seriously as we should. And since this is a social justice issue, how should this be dealt with? We're joined today by Lauren Hale, Associate Professor of Family Population and Preventive Medicine at Stony Brook. She's on the board of the National Sleep Foundation. Richard Stevens is a cancer epidemiologist and professor at the University of Connecticut Medical School. Bryce Mander is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. He studies the role of sleep in cognitive aging and dementia. And we'll get to calls in just a minute. But first off, before the break, Lauren, you were talking about the importance of regular bedtime routines, especially for children.
Sure. Well, regular bedtimes and bedtime routines are important for children and adults. And maybe choice has something to do with the experience of adults. But children should be exposed to regular bedtimes and regular bedtime routines from their parents, and this involves a lot of attention and effort. As a parent myself, I know that it is a challenge to abide by a regular schedule and a regular routine, but it has been shown time and again that young children and even adolescents benefit from having a earlier bedtime, and now that will change as the child gets older, but bedtimes on the earlier side tend to be beneficial for children, and also a routine set of activities that they can associate with going to bed. So sleeping in the same bed, in the same room, in the same way, with the same stuffed animal every night, a transitional object, is beneficial to that child in terms of allowing or teaching him or her to self-soothe and go to sleep. If every night is different and you're sometimes at mom's house, sometimes at dad's house, sometimes there's a party on going on outside the apartment, that's not only distracting, but it's and makes it difficult to sleep, but it is confusing to the child about what is bedtime and aiding and going to sleep at night.
And Richard, how does this apply to adults? Say, for example, someone who has a sporadic schedule but has to work late hours.
Well, that is very difficult. That's one of the challenges we have. People have to do shift work, and we, the larger scientific community, and my colleagues were talking on the phone right now, too, are all really interested in human health and well-being. And people have to do shift work. The more we're learning about the fundamental biology of circadian rhythmicity and sleep, sleep is part of this circadian rhythm, the better we can figure out how to light the environment. And there may be ways. It depends on the kind of shift work somebody does. You've got to be alert for a lot of night jobs, that's for sure. But being alert and having good circadian health sometimes are at odds. Simplistically, but actually it's not simplistic, I think it's true, for those of us who are day workers, getting bright blue light in the morning is good, like the sun would be the best. But if you can't do that, have a nice bright compact fluorescent bulb with lots of blue light. But in the evening, it's the opposite. We want it is better to have it as dim as you are comfortable with and with longer wavelengths. And believe it or not, that would be an incandescent bulb.
Hmm. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Myra in Oakland. Hi, Myra. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just calling because I had a question. I recently had my second child, and I'm pregnant with my third, and I'm starting to go back to work within 3 months of the child being born. Sorry, that's my daughter.
That's okay.
And I realized that I was not really functioning well because the baby's still, you know, waking up two or three times at night. And I was wondering, because I did kind of have a little issue with postpartum depression, and I was wondering if that was also related to my lack of sleep.
All right. Who'd like to take that one?
I will take it.
Lauren.
I am a mother of two, including an infant right now, so I can relate. Having a newborn in the house is extremely disruptive to sleep, especially if you're a nursing mom and the child can't go for long stretches without eating. But even if you're not nursing, sleep deprivation postpartum is definitely associated with postpartum depression, and you should definitely seek medical help to address this. And you should also start as soon as your child is 5 or 6 months to have your child self-soothe so that he or she can sleep through the night, and so can you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. I hope that helps, Myra. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Nancy.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I'm a 76-year-old woman, and I've been having problems with sleeping for, probably 8 to 10 years, and it's very strange. I'll sleep just really, really well for months, and then all of a sudden, I will have terrible problems sleeping. It will be like I'll sleep Tuesday night and Wednesday night for no reason whatsoever. I'll stop being able to sleep, and it will go on for maybe 2, 3, 4 months. And I have trouble falling asleep. Once I fall asleep, I'm fine. I've been to sleep doctors. I've had sleep apnea tests. And nothing, I don't have sleep apnea, but nothing has really worked. I've tried the biofeedback, and I have resulted in taking Ambien or Restorol, and I'm really concerned about it, because especially hearing these two experts about how dangerous it is not to sleep.
Right.
But it's interesting. The one gentleman said that if you do have trouble sleeping, that you should just lie there and rest, whereas all the doctors I've talked to said if you can't, you shouldn't stay in bed for more than a half hour if you can't sleep, and you should get up and read or, listen to the radio or something, which, of course, means turning on the light. And I'm very curious about this complete, change in what he says and what
all right, let's get our guests to respond. Richard, do you want to respond first?
Yes, I do. I'm a PhD, not an MD. I actually teach medical students, so I see how the sausage is made. And I've been involved in this area for a very long time. The sleep hygiene, according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, has changed their recommendations. This notion that you should get up and turn on lights and leave the bedroom, now this is my personal opinion, but I will tell you that it's the whole area of sleep hygiene and medicine is changing. We're trying to evaluate this. If you turn on the lights, you're just not going to get back to sleep easily at all. So we'll see what the recommendations are soon from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. I'm very clear on that waking up in the middle of the night is perfectly normal, and stay in the dark. Now, again, Bryce brought it up earlier, and maybe Lauren too, but if you really do have sleep issues, go to a sleep physician. That's important. But for the most of us who go through episodic restless sleep, don't worry about it.
Bryce, what would you add to that?
Well, I would add that, so the caller had, she had said that she had been tested for sleep apnea, but it sounds like she's been concerned about her sleep and worried about her sleep. So another thing to think about is to talk to a sleep physician about, you know, whether or not she has insomnia, because that is a very different treatment than sleep apnea, and, you know, if that'll may help her deal with some of these worries about it. But, you know, as Richard had said, you know, it's fairly normal to wake up in the middle of the night. And as long as you feel restored and, you know, rested the next day and you can do all of your daily activities, worrying about it too much is actually detrimental.
Well said.
All right. Well, I hope that helps, Nancy, and I hope you get some good sleep soon. There's so much data online. We've got a bunch of links at yourcallradio.org that might help. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Carol in Woodside. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Rose, I really enjoy your program. Every day I try to listen to it.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm calling because I listen to a transistor radio. Now, you might not know what the transistor radio is. They're the little ones that you hold in your hands.
I have one, yeah. Yeah.
So that tells you I'm 75 years old or in that age bracket. I listen to it off and on because I like to listen to the radio, and I miss a good program in the daytime. I want to hear it at nighttime when I'm sleeping. However, I do fall asleep, and then I wake up. I've missed a good part of the program. And I'm wondering if listening, holding that battery-held transistor radio next to my head has anything to do with the fact that I have a hard time sleeping, and I'm tired most of the day.
Do you do that to try to fall asleep, or do you just enjoy it?
I enjoy falling asleep listening to some of the programs that I've missed, like sometimes it's Rose, truly, the KALW programs I like, and I listen to the baseball game, which comes on at 12 o'clock, but it's both. I enjoy some of the programs, and some of the, if I turn on the radio because I cannot sleep or I wake up in the middle of the night and can't sleep.
Well, and I'd like to add a question to what you just posed. What happens when you're listening to a radio show about heavy topics like, you know, poverty or foreign policy at 11 p.m.?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't listen to those.
Oh, you okay, then you don't listen to our show at 11 p.m.
I love to listen to Amy Goodman first thing in the morning. I listen to what her rundown is going to be at 6 o'clock in the morning, what she's going to talk about. I say, I can't take any more of that, and I turn it off until 9 o'clock when I can listen to it.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. All right, Lauren, do you want to take that one first?
I can't answer. I don't know specifically about the transistor radio, but I am curious. You leave it on, so does it wake you when you wake up, as we all do throughout the night? Is it still on?
If I wake up and it's on, I turn it off and
okay.
Try to go back to sleep. But often it's difficult to go back to sleep. Sometimes I will read.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that about the light. When you said you go in the bathroom, turn the light on, that really wakes me up.
Yeah.
I've noticed that, yeah.
Right. I don't have a thought on this. Maybe Bryce or Richard could respond.
Well, I can say a little bit very quickly. Maybe the caller's referring to the electromagnetic fields from the radio, mm-hmm. and that's a very dicey area. I was involved in that for a long time. It's very conflicted. Power line stuff and magnetic electric field, what have you. We don't know what the effects of those are on our health, actually.
Yeah, I wasn't specifically referring to that. I know a little bit about that, too. It wasn't specifically, just that I'm having a hard time sleeping, and I sort of depend on this radio to keep me going at night so that I can doze off and on, and I'm very tired. But also, I think another important thing is that I'm 75, and when you're 75, you're dealing with a whole bunch of other issues that you've never had to deal with before.
Yes, it's a good point. And, Bryce, you study the role of sleep in cognitive aging and dementia.
I do, yes.
And so can you talk to us about that? Like people who are aging and people who aren't sleeping well, how does that affect them specifically?
Right. So it turns out there's now a lot of emerging data to suggest that the more disrupted your sleep is in particular parts of your sleep, the more that certain cognitive functions also start to deteriorate as well. What's interesting is that, you know, back in the, I guess, oh, geez, a half a century ago, maybe a little bit longer, maybe a little bit less, the common thought was, you know, senility or dementia was just a normal part of aging, that you get older and then you lose your mind. But that's not really believed anymore. There are some people that they're sharp as a tack at 93, and some people have more cognitive difficulties when they're sick in their early 60s or even late 50s. And so there's a wide variability in that. And the same is true with sleep. Some people really have good quality sleep as they get older, and this whole idea that, you know, sleep disruption is a common consequence or a inevitable consequence of getting older, is starting, that view in the sleep field is starting to change. There are certainly stereotypic changes to sleep as you get older, but, you know, some people have less of those changes and they do just fine. If you have more disrupted deep sleep, you're more likely to have impaired cognition, particularly in the domains of memory, but also in domains of attention as well, and the ability to focus and concentrate.
And we've done a lot of shows about aging. 10,000 people in the United States turn 65 every day. We recently did a show about Medicare and Medicaid, and so many of these people are really struggling to make ends meet. So once again, the social justice issue comes up here. Is this being studied? Are people in your field talking about this?
There's a little bit of talk about this, but not enough, Rose, that there needs to be more work, more research, and more public outreach. Because, you know, and here's an example. Here's an example of why, right? So the likelihood of getting a sleep disorder, the risk for getting a sleep disorder increases with age, particularly or at least until you're about 80. Then once you get really old, then it actually decreases a little bit. But your risk for getting a sleep disorder, like sleep apnea, for example, increases as you get older. But access to treatment depends on, you know, your financial well-being and your socioeconomic status. So you can tell someone who's got sleep apnea until they're blue in the face, you need to see a doctor. But if they're poor, they don't have access.
Right.
And that's a whole issue. That doesn't just affect older people, it affects everybody. But, you know, there are certain people that, you know, will need some help as they get older, but they'll have less care. And that can actually lead to increased rates of dementia because we know that, say, for example, sleep apnea increases the risk for getting dementia. Mm.
So, Bryce, what kind of research would you like to see? What do you think is missing? And then once that research is done, what should we do about it?
That's a great question. Well, okay, so there's a real lack, at least in the sleep literature, of longitudinal studies to really follow people and to see what role sleep actually plays in cognitive decline in general. There needs to be intervention-based studies that use sleep as a tool to enhance sleep to see if you can reduce the risk of getting dementia or reduce cognitive decline associated with that dementia. And we also need to see closer examinations of disparities across gender. You know, 2/3 of people with Alzheimer's disease are women. But yet it's very controversial whether or not gender, you know, being a woman protects you from getting Alzheimer's or, you know, actually puts you at increased risk. So we just don't understand that. Part of it is definitely a survivability issue. You know, women live longer than men, so of course they're going to be more likely to get a late stage dementia than men. But, you know, there is also evidence that there are some physiological differences that may promote that increased risk. So there's just a lot of lack of understanding in that. And there's also a real lack of understanding of what disparities in sleep across different minority and ethnic populations may, you know, change their risk for getting dementia. You know, certain populations are at increased risk for getting dementia, and they often are low socioeconomic status groups. And so sleep may be playing a role in that.
And so is this research not being done because of funding or because this is just new territory?
Both, I would say, but mostly because it's relatively new territory. I mean, the idea that sleep has any causal role at all with promoting dementia and not just a consequence of a brain ravaged by dementia pathology is relatively new. It's, you know, it really started in animal studies, and the basic science really became strong just, you know, five, six years ago. So there was earlier evidence back in early 2000s and late 90s where you saw these associations with cognition and Alzheimer's disease and its relationship with sleep apnea, or sleep disorders, but there's very little data on it right now. It's a very new area.
And Richard, you've been conducting your research since 1987, so for quite a while now, looking at how the role of electric lighting causes disruption leading to long-term consequences. The big one is breast cancer increases in women. So since this data has come out, and there have been some really good articles about this, what has been done about it? Or what can be done about it?
I really wanted to dovetail with what Bryce was saying and actually ask him a quick question. But the lighted environment impact needs to be a very important component of this research on sleep. Recently, there have been a few reports that light therapy with Alzheimer's patients, that is to have very bright and blue light during the day, helps consolidate sleep and improve behaviors. Do you know about that work, Bryce? And if so,
I do, and I can't agree with you more, Richard. It's absolutely important. The circadian rhythms are monumentally disrupted in these patients, and you know, a lot of times they're put in health homes, and they don't have very good circadian vicapers. They don't have very good cues in the environments. It's lighted night and day, or it's dim all day and night, and it's just there's not enough attention paid to that. And there's also other evidence suggests that independent of sleep, if you look at circadian disruption, so how much the rhythms are irregular or disrupted, that also predicts cognitive decline and aging. So
and I also want to emphasize something that was brought up as extremely important. I can't remember who, but mood and affect and depression are very much, I think it was one of the callers, very much related to our circadian physiology. I think we've all heard, well, in California we don't get it much, but in the Northeast there's a thing called winter depression, seasonal affective disorder, and that is a lack of enough light during the day. But it has application, I think, to people in general. In fact, there's a lot of interest now in the role of circadian physiology in bipolar disease.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling in. We've got time for a few more callers. Let's go to Oliver in San Francisco. Hi, Oliver. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. So I wanted to go on the social justice aspect of it. We've been talking about the long-term effects of sleep deprivation rhythms, notably dementia. I'm looking at a list of kind of immediate short-term effects, and says that you can have memory lapses, cognitive impairments, and I just wanted to note that in the homeless population in cities, when you have the sleep deprivation that kind of comes from the environments you're in, whether it be a shelter, you're concerned about theft and the lighting is severe, or you're on the street and you're being woken up at dawn or whatever, you're likely to have these short-term effects like memory lapses, cognitive impairment, which can in turn make it even more difficult to find housing or employment. And I also wanted to note that this article I have by the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, it says that you can develop a methamphetamine and alcohol habit by trying to adjust for the rhythm. And I just wanted to see what the...
Thank you so much for bringing up the sleep of the homeless population, because that is at the extreme end of a disadvantaged population that suffers from severe both mental health and sleep challenges. And one example of an intervention study that was done in Argentina gave basic housing units, I think they're like moving boxes or something, I should tell you exactly, I have the paper in front of me, to urban residents in the slum, in an urban slum in Buenos Aires, and showed that the provision of a safe, quiet, dark place to sleep really improved the health and well-being of not just the sleep, but quality of life of the residents of the slum. And I think there's such an opportunity here to focus on improving sleep of everyone in the U.S. and possibly starting with a very vulnerable population.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, we have a shelter here in San Francisco for women where they sleep in chairs. They are sleeping in chairs, and the lighting is horrible. And this is how that's how they live.
That's terrible.
That is terrible.
I mean, it's... Yeah. So we've got a couple minutes left. Let's end on the question about social justice. All of you have said that this is so important. in many cases, the research is just getting off the ground. We're just starting to talk about this. Lauren, where do you want this to go, and what can society policies, you know, what would be at the top of your list in terms of how we should deal with this?
Right. From a policy perspective, it's a little challenging to say this one single policy is the answer that will resolve all sleep disparities. But these are policies that are part of a bigger agenda to improve life options and choices for all individuals. Some of these policies include increasing minimum wage, providing affordable, high-quality child care for new parents and families, increasing access to health care for everyone, policies like changing the school start time, especially high school start times, to later. There are many dimensions in which policies can affect people's lives in a way that will improve their sleep. That said, we also need to work at the individual and family level to address pressing concerns like too much screen time, too much caffeine in the afternoon, not enough exercise, and because obesity is also related to poor sleep quality. So there are many levels at which we can intervene, and I hope to see progress on all of those fronts.
And Richard, how would you answer those questions? We've got about a minute.
Keep learning as much as we can about circadian physiology, which includes sleep, the molecular basis of it, and also the technology of lighting. It's moving very fast with LEDs and what have you.
Mm. And Bryce?
I think we need to work really hard on improving the access to care for people who don't have access for care for sleep disorders, and also trying to find interventions that can improve sleep. We need a lot more of that, and then we need to find a way to deliver that. And we probably need to educate the public more about the specific aspects of care and how sleep improves different aspects of their lives.
And when the CDC cited a lack of sleep as a public health epidemic last year, did you see major changes, or are they still to come?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But it needs to be more active than that. We need to put out more service announcements. I mean, for example, you know, when evidence started mounting that smoking can give you lung cancer. Mm. It wasn't just one service announcement that was put out. There was a lot of you know, push to educate the public, a lot of forcing people to brand their products. So we need to really be aggressive about educating people and keep that up and push for policy change that is actually promote sleep. And work hours in general need to be regulated probably.
Bryce Mander is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. Richard Stevens is a cancer epidemiologist and professor at the University of Connecticut Medical School. And Lauren Hale is associate professor of family, population, and preventive medicine at Stony Brook. Thank you all for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What is the state of the Voting Rights Act? On the next Your Call, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that states with histories of disenfranchising voters no longer need clearance to enact new voter laws. The Brennan Center says the ruling unleashed a rash of discriminatory voting laws. This year, 15 states will have more strict rules than they did in 2012. So how is this affecting the right to vote? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.